Good afternoon and good evening and good morning to everyone in Australia and New Zealand. And good morning to those of you in Europe who are up in the middle of the night, which I must say I'm very moved and grateful for. So again, it's a huge pleasure to be with you, to be on the verge of plunging into another session on the heart of the doctrine of recognition. Your heart is the divine heart. Today, we're going to be talking about the mind, using sutras 5 and 6, which if you have your sutra sheet in front of you, you might want to get out. These two sutras explain what happens in the process of manifesting us and this, and essentially offers what to me has been really the major breadcrumb trail that I've been able to follow from my ordinary contracted state of mind to the state of actually being able to experience divine presence in the day-to-day, in the moment-to-moment. So I just want to say that reading your posts this week and contemplating my own experience as I've lived with this text, I keep having a deepening sense of what recognition really means, again, on the day-to-day level. What the text really wants to do here is align us, is to help us actually look at ordinary daily experience. And as we'll see this week, particularly the experience of perception and cognition with the divine experience. So, in other words, to help us align our personal sense of I am with Shiva's experience of I am, which includes the insight that even when we are having a really hard time collectively and personally, nonetheless, the one who experiences this is ultimately Shiva, Chit Shakti. And that means the one who's experiencing the suffering, including the contraction, is Shiva, is Chitti Shakti. This is really hard to believe. As I've said before, we really are asked to kind of up-level our consciousness in order to grok what this text is saying. On the other hand, thank God, the text itself up-levels our consciousness. And that is one of the reasons why I ask you, if possible, to listen to the talk, to the class, a couple of times during the week, at least twice, including this first time, three times, maybe even better. And part of that is because sometimes I talk fast, sometimes you go into meditation. In other words, we don't always hear everything the first time. So to get the sense of it, it's good to listen again. But actually more than that, the reason that I'm suggesting that you listen is because in listening to the class, you're steeping your mind in the teachings of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam and the doctrine of recognition. And you're giving your mind a chance to soak in these truths such that they begin to color your mind. Because as the text is going to tell us, and as those of you who've studied yoga teachings, especially the Yoga Sutras, know, the mind gets colored by what we put into it, by what it observes, by what it perceives. And one of the kind of yoga 101 points about how to transform ourselves is the very profound recognition, which I think many of us have right at the beginning of our journey, but keep coming back to again and again, as I certainly have, which is that the transformation that we seek, the transformation that wants to happen within us is happening in the mind. That said, what we mean by the mind and what Shaivism, what Tantra means by the mind is not just something that's inside your head or inside your skull. The mind, the chitta, the contracted consciousness that we call the mind, is actually interlayered, interpenetrates your entire body. So the transformation in the mind is actually a transformation that will end up being layered throughout all the cells of your body. And this teaching of in Sutra 5 and Sutra 6 is actually the underpinning of a number of discoveries that neuroscience and biology have made in the last 100 years and are making more and more of now, which is how profound the mind-body connection is, how much what you think, what you feel, how you perceive your life affects your physical body, your physical health, and also affects the experiences that you have that seem to be coming to you from, quote, outside. In other words, there is such complete interpenetration of chitti shakti in your inner world, your subtle inner world, your physical self, your body, and what you encounter when your eyes are open and you're interacting with the physical planet. In a certain sense, we could say that Shakti, Chitti Shakti, has manifested within herself a 10-dimensional movie. It's not just 3D. It's got 10 dimensions. It's got dimensions that we are not capable of seeing right now. It's got dimensions that are so thick and dense that it's hard to believe that there is consciousness in them. It's got dimensions that are so subtle that it takes a huge shift in consciousness for us to be able to experience them. And they're all chitti. And I would say that it's always very important in this practice to keep returning to this understanding. It's chitti shakti, it's Shiva shakti, who's living as us and through us. And as I said earlier, chitti shakti is experiencing all of it, including the suffering. The difference is that Shiva's experience, Chitti's experience, is always interlaid with ananda, with the fundamental feeling of blissfulness. For us, in contraction, it can often be a different story. In fact, the more contracted your consciousness, the more you tend to identify with your physical and mental experiences of pain and pleasure, the more you try to acquire love and goodness from outside what you think of as yourself, the more you try to push away failure and discomfort. So, in a certain sense, in practical terms, this teaching encourages us to look at our pain and pleasure, our success and failure, our enjoyment and discomfort, as all manifesting inside one overarching experience whose nature is awareness and bliss. And as we do that, it actually becomes possible to look through the veil and to start to experience the fact that there is actually a sweetness that is intrinsic to life, that under most circumstances we can find hidden beneath what is going on in the mind. I often remember in this context a story that one of my old friends used to tell. He was living in New York City. He was a deep student of this text and of these teachings. and a practitioner. And he one day began to have incredible back pain and was diagnosed as having a very active kidney stone that was trying to get out of his kidney. Now, if you've ever had a kidney stone or any kind of stone that's trying to pass, you know that it really is excruciatingly painful. Not quite as painful as labor, but pretty up there. So he was in a taxi on his way to the emergency room, and he was literally doubled over with pain, completely rolling around in the cab in pain. And suddenly he became aware of this thread of ecstasy that was present at the back of his attention, at the back of his mind, that coexisted with the physical suffering. And he said that he began to chant to himself, "Everything is suffering. Everything is bliss. Everything is suffering. Everything is bliss. Everything is suffering. Everything is bliss." All the way to the moment when the cab stopped in front of the hospital and he was helped out and into the emergency room to have his kidney stone removed, or at least to be given some medicine so that it would pass more easily. So this experience is possible, and it is actually, and as I know many of you have experienced, it's something that can be found under extreme circumstances if we are intending to follow this truth, to follow the breadcrumb trail that Chitti shows us. This is not a fix-it teaching. In other words, this text does not give you step-by-step instructions about how to change your mood, though it's filled with mood-changing teachings. What it does offer you is such a deep perspective on the meaning of life that you begin to be able to discover the fix-it instructions that Chitti Shakti is revealing to you from within, moment by moment by moment. In other words, the Pratyabhijna Hridayam, which comes from a teaching lineage, is infused with the teachers of that lineage. What it does is it kindles that teacher in you, kindles your connection to the inner teacher, so that as you assimilate it, you literally begin to take on the perspective of Shiva. You begin to look at things from Chitti's perspective. Even just for a minute, you can be in the middle of some, you know, intensely challenging situation, or in the middle of a depression, you know, a bout of tuning into your feelings of unworthiness or your feelings of being abandoned, and you'll find yourself suddenly becoming aware of the wider perspective, that you realize that you're experiencing a dance of opposites and polarities that is nonetheless drenched in divine presence, and which can, if you are willing to open to the moment, actually show you that this truth is operating through millions and millions of forms. A teaching like this is like an eyewash that clears your vision of blocks. As William Blake put it, it's a prescription for cleansing the doors of perception. So, but we need to assimilate it for this to happen. And we need to give it a little time, even though I know for many of you there's a kind of a aha that occurs as you listen to these teachings. It's also really important basically to do the homework, that is to meditate, to ask yourself the contemplation questions, to talk to your partner about them. Even though you don't have to do all the contemplations, you don't have to answer all the questions, you don't have to read all the parts of the study guide, it's very important that you read some of them. Because they are showing you how to hack your experience of yourself, how to reframe, to recalibrate your understanding about yourself. And because the density of contraction is really very thick in most individuals, even those many of us who are longtime practitioners, when that veil is operating, you really need the missile of a non-dual teaching to just keep cracking holes in it. Just keep making openings in the veil. And that's when the teachings become a lifeline. So as we said, this week's class is the first of two sessions that we're going to do on the experience of contraction, which, as we know, we actually need to understand, although most of us would prefer not to experience contraction. We would really like to just be reveling in the Empyrean delights of the expanded state. But we do need to get what contraction feels like, for the obvious reason that you can't heal what you can't feel. And healing our contraction is pretty much the first order of business in spiritual life when push comes to shove. So this class on Sutra 5 may seem abstract in certain moments, but actually it's very practical, mainly because it hopefully will give you an understanding that lets you know how to hold thoughts and the process of thinking so as to avoid the tendency that all of us have to believe our most negative thoughts and to let them just skew our consciousness into states where we're just not having a very good time being ourselves. The second reason that this sutra is so practical is because it really does show you how creative your mind is, how powerful your mind is. And it also starts to make the power, the creativity in your mind accessible to you in a much more fluid way. You know, in Tantra, in the Tantric text, especially the pre-Shaiva Tantric texts, as many of you know, and as I have certainly taught you a lot over these years, those of you who've been studying with me for a while, spiritual practice in Tantra largely consists of different practices for, let's say, curing or cooking contracted consciousness through visualization, through mantra, through enlightened thoughts, through teachings, through interiorizing our consciousness and letting it kind of mine the subtle body or the inner body. And the reason for this is that because Tantra recognizes that you and I as individuals are actually way more identified with our mental consciousness, with our mind, than with our body. Most of us define ourselves by the experiences in our mind. So when you understand that, that our definitions, our sense of self is pretty much created in the mind, then you start to recognize that the stories and conclusions that your mind offers you pretty much determine whether you're feeling happy or sad. And so this sutra aims to show us how to make the fluctuations, the fundamental fluctuating nature of inner consciousness, workable. So in other words, it wants to show us how to use Goddess Chitti's powers to transform our experience of ourselves. So we're going to start with our opening ritual. We're going to chant. We'll chant first the goddess mantras, and then the Mahashivaya Satatam mantras. And then we'll offer our practice, we'll dedicate our practice. And then we're going to do a visual meditation on contraction, which is a kind of a classic tantric style meditation, just to get a felt sense of how much we are really living in this experience of being a vast, all-pervasive self which has managed to get itself shrunk down to the size of a human consciousness. So find a posture. We're going to be chanting to the mantras three times each, sung by Scott Schwenk, who's made a very beautiful recording for us with a tambura and a harmonium. So find your posture. We'll take a couple of deep breaths. And with the exhalation, just breathe out the residue of the day as much as possible. And then with the inhalation, feel that the breath comes down into the base of the posture, and with the exhalation flows up to the crown. And now we'll seat ourselves in this grounded place and we'll chant.
Vidhayene Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayene Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne Namah Shivaya Satatam Panchakritya Vidhayine Chidananda Gana Swatma Paramartha Vasne. Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute Om Jayanti Mangala Kali Bhadra Kali Kapalini
Durga Kshama Shiva Dhatri Swaha Swadha Namostute.
We offer our practice this evening, this morning, this afternoon. We offer our practice asking that it be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May we experience equanimity, free of grasping, hatred, and dullness. May we know the unity of all that is. Now, with your eyes closed, see if you can begin to expand your awareness, your sense of self. With the exhalation, feel that your awareness opens past the edges of what we call the body and begins to expand outward through the room. Feel as though your awareness expands past the walls of the room, begins to expand through the building, to expand through the city or the town or the region, expanding wider and wider, so that your awareness now feels as though it takes in and holds the entire region of the earth where you are at this moment. And then begins to expand outward, downward, and upward, so that in your imagination, which remember is simply a limited form of the divine imagination, you are able to expand to encompass the planet and then to open up out into the solar system and the galaxy, throwing your awareness wider and wider. Allowing boundaries to dissolve. Having this thought, my being is wider than the space in which this universe appears. I am vast, unborn. I am unlimited. My true nature is blissful. Notice if there's an edge to your awareness when you're allowing yourself to hold this expanded space. Come up to where you feel might be the edge or the boundary and recognize that actually you can't find an edge. Notice that if you imagine objects inside this awareness, including your body, including the planet, including thoughts, notice how the awareness is actually not diminished or affected. As long as you're holding the intention to experience the wideness of awareness, the edgelessness of awareness, there is this sense of freedom, openness, spaciousness. And now imagine yourself shrinking and see if you can let this happen slowly. Just feel that awareness coming backward, contracting, until you find yourself inside the body-mind, boundaried by what seems to be the body. And notice how you experience yourself. Do you feel squeezed, bound, walled in? Or maybe it feels comfortable to be in this more boundaried space. Maybe it feels more familiar. But can you notice how feelings like constriction or anxiety or judgment or distraction or fear or confusion start to arise when your consciousness, your sense of your own awareness contracts? Just sit in that and recognize that each of us has been through this process. We actually go through it again and again and again, although mostly we don't know it. And many of us have been resisting fully embodying, fully coming into the body in this lifetime. One of the things that makes us spiritual seekers is that we are very, very much wanting to get back to that experience of expansion. So we described this process of contraction last week as we discussed the journey through the tattvas. Tonight we're going to look at the interface, the connection point, where Chitti, who is basically experiencing herself as something that's very much beyond ordinary human mental capacity, for sure. But there's a connecting point where the vastness contracts into our ordinary experience of ourselves. And that is what's happening in Sutra 5. As the vast consciousness contracts to become an individual consciousness. And before we get into the words of the sutra, I just want to say that the Pratyabhijna Hridayam is a story. It's actually a narrative. It describes step by step, as we'll see, the journey into contraction, and we're right now at the point of contraction, and then shows how consciousness gets freed. So, and because it's a story, because it's a narrative, it has an arc, it has a plot, it has conflict, it has loss, grief, and despair, and it has a triumphant denouement. And, you know, it actually has the mythic structure of the hero's journey, of the classical hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell described it. And one of the examples that Campbell gives of the process of the journey, of the hero's journey, is the example of the shaman's initiation ceremony. In a shamanic initiation, the apprentice shaman is literally sent on a journey, which is apparently an inner journey, often involving psychedelic plant medicine, into a dark realm where he or she experiences terrible dangers and undergoes a series of tests, life-threatening tests in many cases. And finally, emerges as a transformed being with extraordinary skills, with shamanic powers, powers that can help humanity. And of course, this is also the classic superhero story. In the superhero stories, the hero or heroine is given a task, undergoes training, then faces the dangers. The Star Wars plot is based on this archetype. The new Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, is the same story, but with a girl instead of a boy at its center. And in this journey, the Prathya Vighneshwarayam, the narrator of the story, the hero of the story, is Shiva Shakti. Sometimes I want to call the central character Shiva, and sometimes I want to call the central character Chitti, but we'll remember that it's the same one. It's Shiva Shakti, who's both telling the story and experiencing the story as you. So Shakti is the omniscient storyteller who's describing what happens, and the protagonist of the story is you and me. Remember, we, as Shiva Shakti, have disguised ourselves and forgotten who we are. So you are that. You're the prince who's been temporarily locked out of the palace, the princess who's disguised as a goose girl. You're the lion cub who's been conditioned to think she's a donkey. You're Vishnu, the god in a woman's body, wandering around trying to find someone to marry. So this painful misunderstanding of being not just a king or a queen, but God in disguise is what drives the plot of this story. And of course, the play of differentiation couldn't take place if you weren't in disguise. You have to believe the story. It's often said about great actors. Daniel Day-Lewis is an example, apparently, of great actors who get very involved in the characters. It's kind of a method acting process where Daniel Day-Lewis specifically apparently gets so involved in a character that he becomes that person even when he's not on the set, which I assume drives his family crazy. And they say that he keeps announcing his retirement because he doesn't really enjoy becoming all these characters in such an intense way. And, you know, we could say that we are Daniel Day-Lewis ready to retire from the play. You know, we want to stop playing the role. But the fact is that as Shakti, even when we decide we want out, there's another part which loves the play, which loves the characters. And that's who we are going to encounter and who we in ourselves are going to be. But again, it's really, really important to recognize that no matter how bad things get, the outcome is going to be fantastic. The outcome is Buddha's enlightenment. The outcome is the moment when, at the end of the Mahabharata, the great Indian epic, which is the frame of the Bhagavad Gita, all the characters who've been at war with each other, you know, who fought these terrible battles, end up in a higher realm, in the realm of Krishna's sublimely enjoyable heaven region, and they're all there together, and there is no conflict because they've all realized that they are not just actors in the play, they're also rays of the great love. So at this point in the story, of course, we're on the arc of descent. And what we are going to find out is some of the answers to the questions that immediately come up. Because if you're told that you are contracted Chitti Shakti, the obvious question is, well, if I am God in a human form, how come I don't experience it? How come I don't have the experience that God has? And the second question you might ask isn't there some part of my experience of myself that could give me a recognizable clue about my true nature? In other words, what part of me is still manifesting my highest truth? Because for most of us, the physical body, at least when we're not really deeply immersed in, in a somatic practice tradition, the physical body feels so dense that it's hard to experience it as subtle transcendent consciousness. The outer world just feels impenetrable. But the part of you where the subtlety and power of consciousness, of chitti shakti, can be known is in the mind, in the chitta, in the inner field of your own sense mind, your human consciousness, which neurobiology, as we've said, increasingly tells us is layered throughout the body, and which also includes not just thoughts, but emotions, imagination, and the frameworks through which we experience the so-called outer reality. Inside our consciousness, our mind, the creative and potentially awe-inspiring qualities of chitti shakti can be sensed, seen, and cultivated. Even if you're not completely aware of how awesome your mind really is, because the mind is where our innate creativity and freedom lives. And of course, the mind is also the field of our suffering. One of the Indian poet saints sang, "Through the mind, bondage. Through the mind, liberation." Another said, "Your mind creates this world, your world." And a Buddha says, if you want to experience beauty in this world, first make beautiful your mind. So here's the sutra, and I'm going to say the Sanskrit. Chittireva chetana padadavaruddha chetya sankochini chittam. Chittireva chetana padadavaruddha chetya sankochini chittam. And the translation, Chitti herself, descending from the plane of pure consciousness, becomes the mind by contracting in accordance with the object perceived. Chitti herself, descending from the plane or the station of pure consciousness, becomes the mind by contracting in accordance with the object perceived. So let's just look at the words. This is one of those sutras in which the Sanskrit is pretty interesting. So first, the word chitti, the goddess herself, chitti shakti. Padad means state or station. Your pada, your station, is where you're seated. It's your level of awareness. Paul Muller has a great phrase, which actually comes from Carlos Castaneda. It's called your point of assemblage. That is the place you sit from which you define who you are. For Chitti in her expanded state, that seat is the transcendent, the non-dual transcendent awareness. For you and I, it might be the heart, or it might be the center of the head. So chitti descends from that state of non-duality. And in the process of descent, she at this point in her descent, she has taken seat. She is seated as chetana, which is the third word. She descends from the state of chetana. So what is chetana? Chetana means consciousness as the pure knower or witness. So if you remember last week, we talked about how when chitti goes through maya, when she goes through the prism of maya, and her powers are shrunken, are contracted by the five cloaks, which limit her omniscience, her all-pervasiveness, etc., etc., she becomes known as Purusha. And Purusha is contracted awareness, the contracted consciousness, post-maya, But Purusha is pure. Purusha is consciousness with no object. Purusha is the pure witness, pure awareness. That experience in you and me is called Chaitanya. And we're going to see, we're going to practice, and many of you will have intuited this immediately. We're going to practice working with awareness, with deeper and deeper experiences of awareness, in order to get directly in touch with that station of chittis, which is called Chaitanya, or pure consciousness. The point is that even when you're experiencing yourself as a limited personal self, immersed in the countless problems and challenges and satisfactions of human life, nonetheless, chitti is there in a very direct form as pure awareness. So avaruddha means descending. So you can imagine chitti, she's oozed down, as it were, or out from, because actually the process of manifestation takes place mostly as a radiation from the center. So she's radiating out, becoming first Purusha, and then beginning to contract a little bit more. Chaitya, the Sanskrit word chaitya, indicates the objects of perception. So if Chaitanya is the word for pure consciousness, chaitya is the word for the objects that consciousness is able to see. The use of the word chaitya, this is why I love Sanskrit, is extremely significant because it implies that the objects of consciousness are also consciousness. That is, the rocks, the table, the other people, and your own thoughts, especially your own thoughts, as we will see. So, chaitya is the object of consciousness. Sankochini means contraction. Sankocha is contraction. Chitta, now we get to the payoff. Chitta is the Sanskrit word for the mental consciousness. It's the field of your consciousness that we are in, that we experience when we are actively thinking, perceiving, defining ourselves by what we see and think and do. And chitta, if you remember, chitta consists or contains three powers. The buddhi, which is usually translated as intellect, which is our capacity for actually being aware of the perceptions and thoughts that are coming up in us. So buddhi is a more contracted version of Chaitanya. Buddhi also contains the capacity for making sense of experience and the quality of discernment or discrimination, which is critical in skillfully living our lives. And chitta also has the power called manas, manas meaning sense mind. Manas is the part of our mental consciousness, of our inner consciousness, which is constantly moving, constantly interfacing with the senses, bringing in experiences, desiring more experiences. So it's the, and manas is also the part of the chitta which throws up thoughts and images, so it's very active. And then there's the ahamkara, which is the eye maker. The ahamkara is that part of the chitta which divides experience into mine and not mine. The chitta is, again, the field in which all of these powers manifest, and we're going to say more about them in a couple of minutes. She, as the contracted version of chitti, is actually, you know, remember that in the first sutra, the text talks about how chitti manifests this universe on her own screen. The chitta is our personal screen. It's in the chitta that we experience everything, including what we call the outer world. We learned some time ago that our brain and nervous system are constantly rearranging the experience of what we call the outer world. turning what is actually a field of undulating energy into the experience of definition and particularity. This is actually what is going on inside the citta, because unlike a physical TV screen, the screen of your citta, of your I'm going to call the, instead of using the word mind, I'm going to use the word citta to describe this. So the citta, that is your mind, is not passive. That's really important. The mind itself is creative. It's as creative as citti, just in a limited way. So the citta is constantly manifesting experience within itself, projecting experience within itself, whether in the form of thoughts or images that seem to come from inside, or in the form of the objects of perception that seem to come from outside. Because even in her contraction, citti is playing as everything in your experience. And the thing is, and this is the essence of contraction, when citti contracts to become citta, the way she does it is by taking on the form of all the objects of perception. So right now, if your eyes are open and you're looking at the computer screen, your entire attention, your mind, has taken the form of the computer. That's how come you can see the computer. You know, it's also taken the form of my words. Everything that's going on in what you call your experience can only be experienced because your citta, the contracted consciousness of citti, has taken on this form. The implications of this: citti becomes the mind, becomes citta, by contracting into the objects of perception. The implication here is that if the objects of perception can be dissolved, if citti can experience herself as the pure screen, then it may be possible to get what the citta really is. And this approach, which is the approach of many, many of the Eastern spiritual traditions, right, is this approach is empty the mind, get rid of thoughts, close your eyes, get rid of perceptions, and then citta will be free of contraction. Well, that isn't really the problem. The problem really is not that the mind is full of objects. The problem, although from another point of view it isn't really a problem, the problem is that you as citta, the ahamkara part of the citta, is identifying itself as the objects, is believing the thoughts, is interacting with everything that's appearing within it as though it were real, as though it were ultimately real. Just hold that thought for a moment. Because you identify with what you are experiencing through and on the screen of your citta, that is, with the contact of the mind, you actually lose the sense of what that screen really is. Let's just hold that recognition for a moment. Close your eyes. And allow yourself to just experience what's going on in your inner field with your eyes closed. There are probably thoughts. My voice is very present in the field, because you're listening to me, of course, I hope. There may be other things going on as well. Some of you will have fallen into meditation, so the field of your citta has some, you know, maybe feels like darkness, or like being pulled inside. There's like a many, many processes going on. But for now, let's, as we turn in and examine the mind, see if you can notice the thinking process, the image-making process. See if you can notice how sounds come in and something in the mind grabs the sounds, makes sense of them, how thoughts come up about it. How the mind may produce thoughts of the laundry or what you're going to do next, or the mind may just be feeling very, very quiet and fit. There's so many possibilities. So as you watch the mind or be connected to the citta, remind yourself, wherever my mind goes, wherever the seeking, moving, roving energies of the manas, the sense mind, whatever ideas are coming up in the buddhi, whatever the ahamkara, the ego, is telling you about yourself, all of this is consciousness. It's all made of mind stuff. It's all being produced by consciousness playing as the mind stuff. So just let yourself notice what happens when you look at your own mind field as the field of chitti's play. Does it change the way your mind is experienced? Does it send you into meditation? Let the thoughts, the images, the sensations arise. Notice how everything that is being experienced inside this field of your own consciousness. And just for a moment, recognize wherever my mind goes, whatever arises and subsides in it, it's all chitti. What happens to the mind as you hold that enlightened thought? By the way, that gong sound is an object in consciousness. So something happened in your citta when you heard that sound. It's quite a beautiful sound, at least I think so, and many of us experience it that way. But it also might have startled you or created a shift. So this is fundamentally the process that is occurring and that you start to discover when you start looking into your own mind, usually in meditation, especially if you look into your own mind with the willingness to recognize the fact that every movement or thought in the mind is an aspect of chitti. I front-load this teaching for several reasons, but the main one is because it happened to be the teaching about meditation that transformed my meditation experience, and can yours. When I was first beginning to meditate, and for many years thereafter, My main experience when I sat for meditation was of endless thinking. Some of you may have that experience as well. I mean, literally endless thinking. And a lot of the thoughts were quite painful. In fact, I remember going to see an Indian Swami whom I've mentioned because he was also my first teacher of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam, and asked him, what should I do? You know, what can I do about all these negative thoughts that are coming up in my mind? And he said, oh, well, what you must do is sit quietly and watch the mind, which is, by the way, as most of you know, a very important technique in meditation, the technique of being the witness of the mind. There was no way I could do that. My thoughts were just too intense and too distracting. I was feeling, you know, sort of incompetent. And the next day, my teacher, my guru, was giving a talk about meditation. And he said, why do you chase your thoughts, trying to get rid of them, trying to make thoughts go away? Don't you understand that the thoughts in the mind are the work of the goddess Chitti, who is consciousness herself, who is the creative force behind every manifestation in the universe? Just as she creates worlds in the cosmos, she is creating worlds of thought in your mind. So stop trying to shut your mind up. Just recognize that Chitti is playing as your thoughts. Now, for me, this recognition was utterly transformative. It broke that very common error that we make as meditators of thinking that thinking is a deal breaker when it comes to meditation, that it's not possible to have successful meditation if you're thinking. The other thing that this teaching does, that this recognition does, is it helps you realize the possibility of intervening in your mental processes. In other words, it shows you how creative you can actually get with the consciousness of your own mind. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Right now, I'd like to discuss the other side of the other big word in the sutra, the word chetana. So we've just talked briefly about chitta, about how chitta, which is the creative, active aspect of chitti manifesting in your inner being, in your inner world. But there's this other aspect of chitti, which is, so to speak, higher, more subtle, more still, more closer to its expanded nature than the chitta, which is chetana, the pure consciousness, the witness, which is always present as the precursor to the experience of the mind as thinker, as doer, as perceiver. And chetana, the pure consciousness that underlies the mind, that is not actually disturbed by the activity of chitta, that holds it, chetana is that aspect of ourselves that we contact when we are practicing being the witness of our thoughts. Chetana is the awareness that begins to come forward when we do that meditative process of being aware of awareness. So chetana is a very pure form of contracted consciousness, and it also happens to be the window or the doorway that we take to rise through, to rise up or to rise in, because it's much more about moving into our center than it is about rising. Chetana, awareness, is the window through which we can look and open up into the world of the higher, more awakened tattvas. And you'll have an opportunity to look at this in more detail, more granularly in the homework this week. Before we go back to the creative aspects of citta, I want to take a few moments and just focus and begin to recognize that chaitanya, pure consciousness not thickened by thoughts and perceptions, is accessible to us directly. And I want to say, for those of you who do a lot of spiritual practice with different teachers or who have in the past, one of the methods, one of the practices that is considered very advanced and very significant, it's a practice that has come to be called direct path practice. And direct path practice is everything that you do to directly contact chaitanya, to directly contact the awareness aspect of chitti shakti. The contracted form of chitti shakti that manifests as pure awareness, pure clarity of awareness. One of the classical Advaita ways of contacting chitti, or contacting chaitanya, is by asking the question, who am I really? Or who is the knower? And again, we'll go there in a few minutes. Another way of contacting chaitanya, which is typically tantric, which is typical of the tradition itself, is to focus on the place from which a thought arises and into which a thought dissolves. And what's profound about this particular practice, the practice of looking for the place in the mind, the place in citta, where thoughts dissolve, is that it shows us how very present and accessible and available pure consciousness actually is. And what's significant about this, about both of these practices of turning directly to the pure consciousness aspect of our individual contracted chitti awareness, both of them show us that when we concentrate on the part of the mind that is not thinking, whether it's by asking, who am I really? Or the one I like is, what is it that knows I'm thinking? In fact, you might ask that question right now. Who is it that knows you're thinking? Who is it that knows you're listening to me? Who is it that knows you're sitting in this seat? Who is it that knows you're in the room you're in? Who is it that knows that you're meditating? Just ask that question. Who is it? What is it that knows I'm here, that I'm listening, that I'm experiencing, that I'm thinking? Who is the knower? Just sit for a moment with that question, asking it from time to time. What happens? What arises? Is there a fraction of a second or more where there's a turning back of attention onto its own capacity for paying attention? Is there a moment where the thinking outgoing tendencies in the citta turn back, turn into itself. And you feel a kind of openness, a kind of unconstructed openness. Who knows I'm here? What knows I'm thinking? So it's Chaitanya, pure consciousness, ever present, and beautiful thing about this particular way of practicing is that when you directly call on or ask for the presence of Chaitanya, ask it to reveal itself, what will happen as you get more and more familiar with that awareness part of the citta, of that less contracted aspect of consciousness manifesting as your individual self-sense. The contracted awareness starts to expand. And I know many of you have had this experience. It's like you find the awareness that's present to your experience. And if you can manage to stay with it, to rest in it, that awareness may flow inward or backward and may expand, and you may have a moment of recognizing that your awareness is bigger than your body, maybe bigger than your house, maybe bigger than the world. It depends on how much awareness wants to reveal itself. But this meditation on awareness is a direct method of opening to the possibility of Chitti letting go of her contraction. And I'm going to give you one more practice, so where you can stand and stretch if you like, move around in your chair, uncoil yourself if that's helpful. Take a few deep breaths. And we're going to perform a meditation practice that is one of the most famous tantric meditations that appears in the Vijnana Bhairava. It's one of the early meditations. It's not easy, but once you understand the principle, it actually becomes a fascinating way to meditate, especially when your mind is full of stuff. So I'm going to give you a protocol for it, and we're going to work right now with the mantra Soha. And I'm giving you the mantra Soha, but if there's another mantra that you're more used to and more comfortable with, you can do it with your own. You can do the same exercise with your own mantra. Just know that I'm instructing you in Soha, so you'll have to, you know, kind of do a hack with the instructions, transpose them. Close your eyes if they're not already closed. Inhale very deeply, so that you feel the breath bringing the base of your body to a much more grounded and sunken experience, so that you're actually taking the support of the seat. and allow the inhalation and the exhalation to flow down towards the base of the spine, towards the pelvis, towards the core of the belly, and then upward to the heart. And begin to say the mantra. But as you say the mantra, Soha, as you repeat it, or Om Namo Narayanaya, or whatever mantra you're using, just make a decision. Don't try to do different mantras. Because this is not a meditation on the content of the mantra. This is a meditation on noticing the place in the mind where the mantra comes to a stop. So if you're meditating with Soha, focus not on the content, but on that moment where ha comes to an end, on that point in your mind, in your inner citta, where ha comes to an end. So as you find that space at the end of the thought, Soha, you may find that you can rest in it for a few seconds and then other thoughts will arise, will emerge. See if you can allow your next repetition of the mantra to reveal itself as arising out of that place in the mind, that place in your inner consciousness where it merged. You're focusing in a soft way, not focusing hard, focusing softly on the place in the mind where the mantra dissolves, just staying as present in it for as long as you can. And when another thought arises, or when the mantra arises, see if you can follow it to the end and find the place where the thought dissolves into the mind. Soha. Now, as you practice this, what you may find is that you're trying to find a place, almost like a point in space, where the mantra dissolves. But that gradually you may start to recognize there's not a point in space. It's more like, as you say the mantra, and let your attention focus where the mantra dissolves, you may start to recognize that the field of your mind, the field of your awareness, is not confined to a particular place, but something about doing this practice makes you aware of your own awareness, of your own chetana. In other words, paying attention to the place where the thought of the mantra dissolves into the field, actually starts to bring online the underlying chetana or awareness aspect of your own inner field. Thoughts continue to arise and subside, perhaps. But maybe you can start to feel where they arise from and what they dissolve into. I'm going to ask for a couple of shares. We're just going to take one or two. And Deb, I just switched us into lecture mode so people can, if anyone would like to share your experience of that last practice or a question about it, you can press star 2 to raise your hand.
Yes, thank you so much. That was very deep. I got stuck kind of with my breath. The mantra was flowing with my breath.
Uh-huh.
And when I stopped thinking about my breath, I stopped breathing. It's like endless moments of happiness not breathing, but eventually I had to breathe again and then it disappeared. So I wasn't sure. I have meditated with my breath a lot. How to overcome this, you know, this binding of the mantra, or like saying it with the in-breath or saying it with the out-breath, or either one, how to get beyond that.
Well, what I would say to you, that's a really good question, and I think it's a question that many people can relate to, especially if you are used to saying the mantra with the breath, which I do this also. I've spent so many years coordinating the mantra, that the mantras I work with my breathing process, that I pretty much always do that. One of the teachings in the yoga text is that the prana and the mind, the prana and the chitta, are completely connected. When the mind gets quiet, when chitta gets quiet through a process like this, the breath will often also stop, and vice versa. When the breath stops, the mind, the chitta gets quiet, unless, of course, we get scared and think, oh my God, I'm not breathing, or there's something wrong, and another thought comes up. But the experience that you describe is actually a variant of the experience of finding the place where the mantra ends and experiencing the stillness of awareness as chetana, because the end of the breath and the end of a thought are the same open spaciousness. Basically, what happened was completely perfect. Does that make sense? Did I explain that in a way that you can
it makes total sense to me. However, if I it seems I have to tell my breath to breathe.
Well, I try not telling your breath to breathe, because okay. Honestly, again, I'm giving you a yogic explanation for this. In the in the tantric approach to this whole area of breath and the stilling of the breath, what happens when you go very deep in meditation is that the breathing stops going in and out of the nostrils, you know, in and out of the Ida and Pingala nadis, if you want to use the words that the text use, and begins to flow in the central channel, in the Sushumna, where it doesn't come out of, it doesn't flow out of the nostrils. So when the breath has internalized, you don't have to breathe through the nostrils. So if you can hang with not being able to breathe or not breathing without getting scared, that state will expand and become a samadhi state, a state of expanded awareness. In other words, chitta will expand into chitti. Chaitanya will expand into chitti through this process.
Thank you.
You're so welcome, and thank you for the question. You don't have to, if you're in meditation and the breath has stopped, just let it be like that for as long as it is, and you'll start breathing again through the nostrils when it's time to come out. So it's not a problem. In fact, it's attainment. So congratulations. Your pranas get still. Okay, thank you.
We have somebody from Morro Bay.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. So wonderful to be in this class. I just so appreciate you and all of your teaching and all the classes. So, when I was going inward and you had us focus on the ending of the ha,
mm-hmm.
like ask where does that go, I felt it turn, that I turned inside myself, that it actually came back to inside. It's a very hard experience to describe, but it kind of flipped itself inward, if that makes sense.
Yes, it really does. Very hard to describe, I know.
And the question, you know, I started to feel quite anxious about who am I, who knows that, especially the who knows that I'm thinking, and who knows I'm sitting here. I felt some anxiety and fear because I think it gets to the heart of the matter is that I don't exist.
Yeah.
And
well,
which is kind of a revelation in and of itself. I mean, that's the ultimate egolessness. And I'm reminded of, I had very limited, my mother went through this phase. She eventually became a born-again Christian when I was 13, but she went through a phase where she took me to some transcendental meditation classes with her, maybe 4 or 5 times. And when I was around 9 or 10, and after that, I don't know if it just came to me, but I would spend hours and years asking myself, who am I? And playing this game in my bunk bed, I can remember just asking myself, well, my name is Dawn, but that's a name that's given to me. And I would try and move backwards to where I came from. And then my body would shudder when I would get to the place that I realized that Dawn is just a name. I don't identify with it. And it was very similar tonight for me here.
Yeah. So, first of all, Dawn, can you mute yourself? Because I'm hearing my voice through your
phone.
Okay, so you can, just mute yourself, pressing *6, and you'll become muted. So, first of all, you do exist. You just don't exist as Dawn. You exist as Chaitanya, as Chitti, Shakti, as Shiva. And yes, this process will take you beneath the structures of the Chitta. It'll take you underneath Ahamkara so that you start to experience pure existence or pure consciousness, what Jiddu Krishnamurti, the spiritual teacher who lived somewhere in your neighborhood, actually, called bare awareness, you know, pure awareness. And what happens then is that the ahamkara, the ego, which is very vigilant, rises up and manifests as fear. Oh, my God, I don't exist. And that is really scary. So you just have to remind yourself that actually you are experiencing your existence, but at a deeper level than normal. So does that make sense? You can unmute yourself.
Yes. That brings some peacefulness to it.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
Is there something more you want to ask or say, Dawn?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for this sharing and for this question, because it's, again, both of you guys have, I think, brought up issues that are very normal when we start to access the underlying chaitanya aspect of your mind. As this process continues, and again, I know many of you have done this kind of practice, and many of you do this kind of practice now, and we are actually practicing it during our meditations on when we practice awareness of awareness. So when you focus on the sensations and the sounds and the breath and the thoughts, and then become aware of the awareness that allows you to experience them, you're accessing chaitanya, you're accessing this subtle substratum of your thinking mind. And in my experience, and I think probably for many of you, that once you can actually begin to experience awareness or awareing as yourself, in other words, once you have enough of a experience of awareness of chaitanya such that you can go there, you know, you can access it easily. Again, there are many of you here who have easy access to that awareness. The thing about it is that it is very freeing, in that when you're aware of awareness, you're much less aware of what's going on in the contracted citta, which usually means that you're more detached from whatever thoughts or feelings are coming up and creating issues for you. And this approach, the approach of becoming aware of awareness, or directly tuning into that in you, which is unchanging, you know, which is just present no matter what else is going on in the mind, that practice is, it's a very revered way of tuning into your own freedom. It also, again, as many of you have experienced, it's also an invitation to something that is generally called spiritual bypassing. That is, we identify ourselves with chaitanya, with awareness, and somehow manage to bypass the structures of citta and to kind of detach ourselves from being at the effect of what's going on in the external world. And it is a certain point, the tantric sages tell us, even though that is a state of higher awareness for sure, at a certain point, Chitti Shakti wants us, or intends for herself, because she is us, to experience what it's like to realize the sacred nature of your own citta, even when the citta, the mind, is clogged with thoughts, even when the citta is agitated, even when, you know, you're experiencing the pain of negative thoughts like so-and-so is a bad person, or I'm not worthy of love, or I didn't get it, or just your identification with I am Dawn. You know, I live in the Central Coast of California. I have kids named, what your kids are named of, named I'm Rebecca. You know, I'm a divorced 37-year-old accountant, and I live in suburban Philadelphia. Those ways that we identify with the objects of awareness, and in the tradition we come to understand that the body is an object of awareness. The thoughts are objects of awareness. When chitti contracts, fully contracts to become chitta, that's how she does it. She does it by identifying with the body, with the thoughts, with the beliefs, with the feelings, with the stories, with the whole display of, you know, which allows the individual to construct a self, you know, out of the materials that are arising and subsiding in chitti. And again, this is not news to most of you. When a happy feeling arises, it colors our consciousness, and we identify with it. And so we will tend to say, I'm happy, I feel good. And when we make a big mistake, we often, the first thought is very, very, especially if we, you know, were brought up in a family that didn't allow for mistakes, it gives us a very bad feeling. So much of the psychological work that we do, which is valuable and important, is about learning to basically reframe the way the thoughts that we hold and to look into the thoughts that we hold. And, you know, there's an enormous field of psychology now, or that's been around for 50 years or so, which uses cognitive reframing. You know, you change your thoughts, and that changes your experience to some extent. And the reason that this is important, and the reason that it's, you know, that it's actually an advance in human psychological evolution, it's because the way we experience ourselves is always dependent on what the chitta is holding in itself. So, you know, it's one of the major subjects of Eastern spirituality. In fact, every form of spiritual practice points to this fact that when the mind holds on to anger, it becomes an angry mind, and you become an angry person. Because as Sutra 6 says, the individual under the influence of Maya experiences itself as the mind, as the chitta. What you're experiencing in the chitta is who you are right now. You as an individual. This is a mind-blowing idea. You as an individual are the contents of your own chitta. And that means that you as an individual are, when your chitta is light and happy and having positive thoughts, you in that moment are what we would call a positive person. When your chitta is full of paranoia or anger or judgment, you are in that moment a paranoid. You're an angry person. And that transformation that occurs in each of us through the thoughts and perceptions that we're holding in the mind is our way as individual expressions of chitti shakti. That is our way of recognizing the unbelievable creativity of consciousness as it works in us. That creative consciousness manifesting as thoughts and feelings and as perceptions is also, again, as most of you know, actually having an enormous effect on what goes on in what you experience as the outside world. And I'm going to tell you a story that's one of my favorite stories in a whole genre of anecdotes that relate to what happens when we hold delusive thoughts in our mind, which we often do. This happened in the 1970s. I've been telling this story for many years, in New York City to a friend of mine who one day was walking along one of the pathways on the Upper West Side that leads past Central Park, on Central Park West in Manhattan. And at that time, it was quite a dangerous neighborhood because muggers used to lurk in the park and come out and, you know, take the wallets or sometimes even physically hurt passersby. So my friend was hurrying because his house was he was a few blocks from his house. He was hurrying down Central Park West, and he heard footsteps behind him, and the footsteps were coming closer and closer, and he got more and more scared. He was sure it was a mugger. And then this person behind him passed him and kind of bumped into him and then moved on very fast. And my friend thought, oh, my God, he's stolen my wallet. He reached into his down to his hip pocket where his wallet usually was, and it wasn't there. With, you know, a complete adrenaline surge and an enormous courage, he leapt out, grabbed the man who had bumped into him from behind, put his arm around the guy's neck and says, give me back the wallet. And the guy just reached into his own pocket and handed my friend the wallet. And my friend, and then ran away. My friend was very happy with himself. I bet you know the end of the story. He got home. He opened the door, and on the hall table, he saw his wallet. He had left it at home, and he had just allowed his mind to turn him into a mugger. I'm not sure what he said to the guy when he returned his wallet, but this actually is what the mind does to us. We literally become at the effect of our mental states, which is why the sages say, through the mind bondage, through the mind liberation. And, you know, we're seeing this in spades these days in the polarization in the United States, in the polarization of the political parties. And, you know, for many of you, the polarization in your families. Members of one camp look at President Trump and see a greedy, narcissistic, incompetent, amoral plutocrat who has somehow by accident gotten into power and is destroying the lives of hardworking immigrants and dismantling environmental protections and, you know, kind of wrecking American democracy. Members of the other camp see him as a brilliant iconoclast who's disrupting the deep state, bringing back American jobs, getting terrorists out of the country, or at least making it possible for socially conservative agendas to be put through. Both camps are looking at the same person through the lens of their mental field and seeing a very different reality. Now, I have a viewpoint about this, as many of you do, but the fact is that holding those viewpoints, can you see how they completely skew your experience of what is apparently going on outside? They take over your life and they take over your body. So in this moment, in Sutras 5 and 6, Chitti, descending from the state of Chaitanya, of pure consciousness, becomes Chitta by contracting in accordance with the objects of perception and also contracting in accordance with the attitudes, the conditioned attitudes that you happen to have about those objects of perception. In working with our suffering, we start with the citta. And almost every form of spiritual intervention in some way works with the citta and the thoughts in the citta. I mean, I have always loved, and as many of you do, the way Byron Katie, the great spiritual teacher Byron Katie, works with people's ideas about what their life means. And you know, she listens to someone talking about how they're suffering and how their husband should be nicer to them, and how their boss is a bastard, and how their life situation is so terrible. And she would have them ask a series of questions. The first one being, is that true? And the person would usually say, yes, it's true. And then the second question is it really true? Is it true under all circumstances? And then the third question, which is, I think, really skillful, is who or what would I be if I didn't have this thought? And in that moment, you're using your citta. You're using the buddhi aspect of your citta to reframe your experience. And what usually happens when someone asks that question is that there's a release. And there's an experience of the uncluttered citta and often of the presence of awareness behind it, within it. And then her fourth question is, turn it around. So if you're thinking, my boss should be nicer to me, maybe turning it around would, the answer to that question would be, I should be nicer to my boss, or I should be nicer to myself. So these are four methods, and there are many more, for working with the citta's tendency to polarize around ideas about the objects of our experience. But what I'm going to ask us to do in the next few minutes, in our last few minutes, is to really get into the fundamental creative process that is going on as citta manufactures the experience of thinking, image making, imagination, and taking in what we consider the world. And we're going to just begin by working with a particularly contracting thought. And I'm just going to suggest that you find a contracting thought, and not necessarily the thought that puts you into a state of panic, but a thought that gets you stuck in some way. For me, one of the contracting thoughts is, I have a deadline and I'm not ready, and I might not be able to meet my deadline. Do you hear that? So, and that, when I have that thought, oh my God, I have a deadline and I might not be able to meet it, it creates a whole complex of stress, what we call stress, inside me. My heart beats faster, my breath becomes short. As we all know, these kinds of thoughts can have enormous impact on our whole, on our entire body. I'm going to ask you to choose a contracting thought, a thought that causes stress, but not so much stress that we're going to lose you, and just bring it into the forefront of your mind. So you have your thought. Now, imagine, this is the way I like to do it. It might be too violent for some of you, but the way I like to do it is to examine the thought, oh my God, I'm feeling so much stress, as an object inside your citta. For instance, you might imagine it written. You might experience it as an image. And they're going to be somatic experiences that go along with it. But right now we're focusing on the structure of the thought or the image. Now imagine that a big hand comes down, you're creating the hand in your mind, and crushes that thought into particles. Or if that feels too violent, you can imagine a broom coming into your mind and sweeping the thought away. But what happens as you do it is that the thought so much stress, or George hasn't called, or whatever it is, notice how it kind of dissolves into particles. So see if you can use your attention to focus on the space left by the dissolution of the thought. And now bring the thought back. And, you know, you might actually imagine yourself taking particles, taking little glops of consciousness stuff and reforming the thought. Oh my God, there's a deadline. Or whatever it is for you. Reform the thought. Creatively reform the thought. Feel what the trailing somatic and psychological residue of holding that thought is, and then crunch it again. Let that big hand come, sweep it away with a broom, just disappear it, dissolve it, and focus on the space in awareness, in citta, where that thought resides, where that thought dissolved, what's left of it. And before other thoughts come up, which they probably have by now, but notice how there is a kind of spaciousness, a sense of presence, perhaps a sense of dynamic peace that you can find when you actually deliberately dissolve a contracting thought. And I've asked you to do this process. Again, some of you have done this process with me before. It's one of my favorite ways to work with painful thinking, with painful images. It's not that you're trying to, it's not so much that you're trying to get rid of the thought. What you're trying to do, the purpose of this exercise is to allow you to realize that that your mind, which is so infinitely creative, can use its creative power to transform the way you're thinking about something in a very immediate way. So in other words, you don't have to go through the whole process of saying, it's okay, I can make the deadline, not that that's a bad thing to do, or, you know, it's not as bad as you think, or actually I'm a very worthy person. In other words, you don't have to substitute other thoughts for it to experience the creative power of your consciousness to free yourself from contraction. You just have to imagine the thought construct, which is made of consciousness. You just have to imagine that dissolving. And I think many of you may recognize this is a direct method of intervention into your own mental process, the type of mental process that generally causes suffering. We worked with it actively in this meditation. Another way of working with contracted thoughts or painful thoughts or thoughts that tend to squeeze consciousness into harsh boxes is simply to pay attention to that thought construct, to allow your attention to be present with it, and to just notice that as you let your attention be present with a contracted thought construct, it will naturally tend to dissolve or evanesce into consciousness stuff out of which it's made. And that's the point. Everything that arises inside your chitta is made of mind stuff, of energy. And that energy is chitti, is shakti. We're going to end in just a moment. Let's just take ourselves back into a strong seated posture. Feel that your attention turns inward. Let yourself experience whatever is going on in your chitta. Just thoughts arising and falling. Images, feelings, breath. You're allowing yourself to be fully present with whatever is arising in your inner field at this moment. Thoughts, images, sounds, flow of breath. If your eyes are open, what you're seeing. If your eyes are closed, the sense of the inner landscape. With that kind attention, to use a Buddhist phrase, with that subtle attention to the field and its contents, have the thought, whatever arises and subsides inside this inner field is made of chitti shakti. It arises from chitti shakti, it dissolves into chitti shakti. Though I may be experiencing myself as the self that the chitta tells me is me. Behind that construction is the open, creative, dynamic field that is chitti herself manifesting as my own mind. And inwardly bow to your mind. Offer an inner salutation to the creative power of your own mind with gratitude for the cunning and brilliant way that Chitti Shakti has constructed, expressed, and allowed you to experience a world through the amazing power of your own consciousness. Have a beautiful evening. Homework, and of course the audio will come tomorrow. So much love. Good night.